The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Football is about nothing unless it's about something, and what it is about.
I am going to get 100% out of you.
If it wasn't for a twist of fate, my next guest today's name would be familiar to you all. This guy was an exceptional footballer who, like too many before him, was denied fortune and glory by injury, and almost as cruel is the fact that we were denied the chance to see him do it and progress. I was lucky enough to see him play for Manchester City, captain Manchester City, and anyone who did likewise is going to tell you that he would have gone on to play for England and captain England as well. Now he's got a book out, it's published by Century on August the 4th. I'm going to read you something that our friend Oliver Holt wrote about it on Mirror Football on July the 20th. And this is what Ollie wrote. He said, "I read Paul Lake's autobiography, I'm Not Really Here, from cover to cover yesterday. I started it, I couldn't put it down. It's the best book I've read for a long time. It's not easy reading, in fact some of the passages in it made me cry. Beautifully, powerfully written, it's particularly raw and unsparing about the former Manchester City captain's brutal struggle with injury." So Paul Lake, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Steve. Yeah, I seem to have come through the worst. I've still got a legacy of problems with my knees, but that's my cross to bear. But in the scheme of things, playing for the club that I loved as a child, I think it's been worth it.
When you read something like that, I guess you went through a painful time writing this book. Was it cathartic to getting it all out of there, or did it drag up bad old memories of what happened to you?
I think it was a mix of both, actually, Steve. I'm certainly reliving those days at Lillishaw when I spent a year of my life rehabilitating, and the succession of operations that failed. And actually having to relive those moments and recount it to the nth degree was actually quite painful. Alongside, whilst I was at Lillishaw, my father passed away. So it was pretty painful. But I think in the scheme of things, as I look back at that kind of journey, if you will, from being a fan to being an apprentice to being a first team player and all those heights and then the sort of lows afterwards, I've been able to sort of balance the two. And as the book's called, I'm Not Really Here, Life of Two Halves, I've kind of looked on it as being a cathartic process of where I've ended up, and that's where I am emotionally. I'm really happy, settled, got a lovely wife and lovely family, and in the scheme of things, apart from my physical problems, I'm in a really good place.
For people who are not familiar with your story, let's go back 21 years to the start of the book. Then it's August 1990. Can you explain where you are at that moment and what you think's lying ahead of you?
Yeah, well, I'd just been in the World Cup '90 squad, and I'd missed out. And the England manager at the time, Bob Robson, spoke to me saying that he had plans that if I kept on the way I was going, there's no reason why I shouldn't be captaining the national team, and that you should be, you know, really, really proud of yourself, and you're definitely on our radar, and keep up the good work. So with that, Howard Kendall was the manager, well respected, and he'd basically waxed lyrical about me to everyone, and I'd since known that both sides like United, Liverpool, Arsenal and Rangers had made bids for me, so I was in a pretty good place and feeling really, really confident. And then, of course, being made captain and 2.5 games into the season, I fell over, twisted my knee after tackling Tony Cascarino. And I felt that something wasn't right, but little did I know that that was going to be the start to the end of my footballing life.
Hmm. Now, I mean, that injury was initially, it was just said to be a minor knee injury, wasn't it? And then it turned out that you'd done a cruciate. What effect did that delay have on what happened to you after that?
Well, it was bizarre. I'd actually been told I had a twisted knee. Now, since I qualified as a chartered physiotherapist, looking back at those times and that kind of a statement is a ridiculous statement to give somebody who's in the throes of a knee that all the signs and symptoms are something far, far more serious. And I spent 6 weeks of that time of getting my strength back, and then spending 3 weeks solid up and down the stands in the kickbacks, going doing these weights, those weights, spending all this time being told that everything's okay and don't worry, everything'll be fine. And so you put your faith in people and trust in people and what they say medically. So then, after 6 weeks, to fall flat on my face and be told, actually, this is more serious. That I'd ruptured my cruciate ligament and I was going to be out a minimum of 6 months. Obviously, being a young man as well, you don't know where that's going to take you. And it's a hard place to be in. You know, you don't get the advice that you need to sort of put things to bed and have that reassurance that, okay, project yourself 6 months from now, you'll be back on track, your career will be salvaged, don't worry about it, everything will be okay. But you have no guarantees. I had no guarantees in those days, and I had no advice either way. So I was in a pretty scary place, and I was clutching at straws pretty much all the time.
Hmm. And then, I mean, what happens next is it wasn't 6 months, obviously. It was pretty much two seasons, wasn't it? And then you come back at the start of the first Premier League season, and more or less straight away it happens again. That must have been completely shattering.
Well, if you can appreciate the fact that I'd basically been in a zone for all of that period of time. All my conversation, my life was ruled by my knee. You know, every single conversation I had with anyone started with, how's your knee doing? You know, wake up in the morning, the first thing I'd do was check my knee and see how it's feeling, how it's looking, before I even stood up. You know, I'd get in and out of cars and I'm checking, sitting down, standing up. Everything was all about my knee. It became all-consuming. And then, obviously, I'd worked as hard as ever I could. And I was told that everything's fine, everything's back on track now, you have no problems. Again, putting your faith in people. And each time I was let down, that I sunk even further. And having to come back from those depths to come back again, to try and come back and then to be knocked down every time. And I'm just being led by different people who were telling me what to do and how to do it. And I couldn't have done any more. And I stuck to the letter like you wouldn't believe. Mm. You know, I wasn't a drinker. I didn't, you know, sort of waste my time. Everything I did, every second of my lifetime and during those days was focused on doing the right things in the right way, what I ate, you know, what I drank, how I conducted myself on and off the training pitch, on in the gyms, etc. So I was so devastated when this happened for the second time, and I'd obviously learnt, because unfortunately, for what people say is that a little bit of knowledge is dangerous, and unfortunately, I was going through articles and reading about knee injuries and saying that if it happens the first time, it happens the second time, how would that leave me both now and in the future? So I was scaring myself at the same time and didn't have a sounding board, no one to be advised from, no one to look after me. And so from a physical state, which was obviously not particularly good, suddenly I was in a very poor psychological and emotional state, and I was on a downward spiral.
Mm. A player who had that kind of injury today, how would you, I mean, you've been a physio at Bolton and other clubs. How would a player like that be treated, both physically and psychologically? And what kind of time would, I mean, you were out for 2 years, and then obviously that was it. The second time. How would a player like that? When would they be able to come back? Right? How long would they be out?
Well, they would be been out a minimum of 6 months. And I mean, I after my first operation, I was actually back doing pitches work about 2 months too early on the advice of the medical team. Mm. And that's when my knee ruptured at Lillishaw, and it partially ruptured. And then I had to wait until the pre-season training with the episode with Gary Megson before it actually properly ruptured. But the players today, and obviously the players that I've worked with, even when I worked at Altrincham at Macclesfield Town, you know, the procedure was very, very, very specific, pretty rigid, and very, very careful from the three months of rehabilitation onwards till you get onto the pitches and doing that sort of late-stage rehabilitation. But you're looking at 6 to 9 months maximum. But the physical care, the attention, the time that you are given, it's always a one-to-one. So, for instance, we had a player that I took over to the States. I flew over with that person myself. They had another person from the football club to oversee that. Whilst he was rehabilitating, he always had one physiotherapist with him. He also had one masseur to work with. They had a full-time psychologist that was available at any time and a full-time doctor that was available at any time. So as you can appreciate, that medical backup was so strong and it was there was so much communication for that person, both between medical people and between the management team and the player and the medical team. So everyone was fully abreast of what was happening, that we knew where the player was at physically, we knew where he was at psychologically, and as important, we knew where he was at emotionally. And this now is pretty much standard and has been for the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years, but certainly at my time at City, unfortunately, there was a part-time doctor and a physiotherapist that was a smashing guy but wasn't fully qualified, and he had 40 to 50 players under his care and supervision.
It's quite incredible, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, and obviously you did go out to America as well to try and piece things back together, and not in any kind of luxury, certainly not with people counselling you in your ear and stuff like this. I mean, who do you blame for all of this? Do you blame people?
I look back at the football club at that time, obviously, from sort of the mid-80s to the sort of, I don't know, early 90s, the medical attention at the club was definitely, I'd say, semi-professional. I would go as far as to say that. And certainly there was no real understanding of its importance. Now, it goes without saying that at football clubs you have several physiotherapists, you have several masseurs, you have the psychologists, you have sports fitness conditioners, you have specific people that target certain areas that all work together as one big team headed up by a club doctor. But in those days, everything was done sort of to try and save money. The saddest thing for me is the fact that the club had insurance, and even to get advice from 2, 3, 4 different consultants would have been a phone call and a trip either on the train or in the car. So you have to look and say that the football club was culpable at that time, you know, whereas the club now is just in a different world to what it was then. But my struggle is the fact that there are certain things that and certain conversations that I had both with Peter Swales and other members of the medical team, and I was just being let down badly. But the saddest part of it all was that a lot of it was put back onto me, like it was my fault. And because you're a young man and you don't really know the ins and outs of what's happening and where and what place you're going to be in the next sort of 5-10 years, you really don't know what to say. And it's hard when you've got chairman and directors saying things to you and you've got nobody fighting your corner. So really, a lot of the blame I took upon myself. And looking back, that was another bitter pill to swallow, because I internalised everything. And the person that ultimately suffered, apart from my physical problems, was the emotional and psychological person, which was obviously me.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I guess I probably met you. You hadn't retired then, but it was definitely on the table, you know. And that would have been around 94-95 time, and 95 time rather. And you know, I was kind of astonished by the way that you were dealing with it all. But that was a little bit of a front, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly, Stephen. And that's something that I look back upon, and I don't really know how I managed to do it, really, because every single day was a front. Every single day for a period of probably 3 years was an effort to get out of bed, was an effort to even, you know, socialise, never mind to do my job or try to do it and try to be the best that I could be and be as professional as I could be. Everything was an effort, and so every day coming home to an empty house was just the most difficult time. I probably can honestly say that the 1990s was the most miserable time of my entire life. And now for that almost that 10-year period, even from when having to retire and try to gain qualifications as a chartered physio, that still took 4 years because it was part-time at Soft University on the PFA's course. So for 10 years, really, I was in such a you know, a sorry state and struggled along, you know. So it was, people look back at certain points in their time with happiness, and unfortunately, even though I played 130 games for the club that I loved, I would say the majority of those memories are really sad ones.
There are some pretty harrowing moments in the book. What was kind of the lowest ebb that you got to, and how did you get out of that? You did actually try and get some help in the end, yeah?
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, I'd had depression and didn't realise that it was as serious as it was, and I just had to. There came a point where I had to go and see the doctor, and he said he understood, and I basically broke down. And it must have taken about 2 months to pluck up the courage to go and see the doctor. And then once I was in there, he couldn't get me out. Basically, I just fell apart. And I look back at that person then, and I don't recognise him. It's like an out-of-body experience because of the person that I am now, and how strong-minded and strong-willed I am. I just was just falling to pieces. And so I'd suggest that particular day, the fact that I was going nowhere, that I knew I was going to have to retire at some point, it wasn't going to work out. And as importantly, what the hell was I going to do next? That was the scariest thing. It was the unknown. I had friends of mine that had been in their jobs 10 years and were at a certain level where they were comfortable, they'd had a career pathway lined up for themselves. And, you know, as far as all my friends and even my family were concerned, they were all settled in their lives. I was having to start again. And to do what? I didn't really know. You know, I'd put all your eggs into one basket, which is not the right thing to do. But, you know, I was told that, you know, I had pretty much a guaranteed contract to City, and all I was going to be was a footballer until I had to retire by the age of 35, 36. And this is what a lot of young men, unfortunately, see that, and are almost in a little kind of a bubble, really. So from that point, having to be with the doctor and to fall apart and to worry about the now and what's going to happen tomorrow, I was in an absolutely desperate place. And when I even talk about it to you now, I can honestly say I've got a sick feeling in my stomach, because it's like when women have a baby, they say that you have a baby and you kind of forget those pains, otherwise you wouldn't go through it again. But you have got a sense of them. And I've certainly got a sense of my depression, because as an illness, it never truly leaves you, but it's just how you keep it at bay and how you cope with that. But certainly it was the most miserable, desperate time of my life. And, you know, thankfully, I'm in a fantastic place, and I don't ever see myself getting that low again.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, you know, a very low place, suicidal moments. Yes, I know so many footballers who've said this, who've not been injured out of the game, who've just ended football because they, you know, they've retired.
That's right. Well, yeah, it was particularly low, and as I say, I mean, everyone's interpretation of the word desperate, you know, conjures up different images. But certainly for me, you know, I wasn't far from getting to those sort of depths. But I managed to sort of steel myself and realise that, you know, I have got a lot to live for. And people don't understand when there's so many people today in society that have got their own woes and problems financially, you know, emotionally. You know, everyone has their crosses to bear. But for me, I was conditioned, as far as I was concerned, I was just conditioned to be a footballer. I didn't know what else to do, where else to go with it. Yeah. And so people talk about a fall from grace. I plummeted. And basically, I had no one to help me get back up there. And I mean, luckily, I found that the PFA was a body who I could turn to, and they became pretty much an emotional crutch for me. And then I managed to get my kind of a level playing field where I could start to build from. And a light at the end of the tunnel was because of the fact that I knew I could do something that I would be okay at, with enough experience of the footballing world to bring something to the table and to try and get some self-satisfaction.
And did you consider legal recourse against City? Did you? I think that everyone suspected that when you'd retired, that you would retire with an enormous insurance payoff, and that would take away some of the pain. But clearly, that isn't the case.
No. Well, I was advised to. If I'm being brutally honest, I was advised by two solicitors to that if I wanted to be comfortable, to to sue the football club, and that would be it. But I just, you know, when, and it sounds, this isn't meant to sound like I'm some kind of martyr, because I'm certainly not. But I couldn't sue the football club. I couldn't sue my team. It just didn't sit right with me. And I was actually insured for £10,000, which, again, when I was rated at 1.5 to 3 million pounds, and Howard Kendall often said that he'd ask as much as 10 million pounds for me, when people didn't even talk about those kind of sums, you know, which is kind of to say. But, you know, that I was insured for £10,000, and I didn't even receive that. I did have a testimonial, but as we know, compared to the sort of, I mean, it was fantastic for the fans, both City and United fans, to come out, and I totally respect them for it. But it, you know, it wasn't going to set me up for life, and didn't and hasn't done so. But it wasn't about the money. It was about the principle of all of it. And I know for a fact that I've spoken to friends since that even Remy Moses back in the early to mid 80s, you know, was paid handsomely in the insurance policy payout by comparison. But you know, that's in the past, Steve. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I've managed to put that to bed, and I've come away from that, and I'm in a much happier place. And I would like to add, Steve, as well, that the book is not a misery.
It's not a misery memoir. No, it's not. It's got a lot of funny stuff in it. You know.
Yeah, exactly. And there is a lot of, and I've had to bring that to the story, and that there are some. Sometimes you might consider it as being black humour, but something that I've used and I've managed to sort of deal with my problems has been through humour and through music, and that really has been such a huge help in my progression from those dark days to where I am today.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's every for people who've not seen the book yet, which it, you know, please rectify that. But every chapter heading is the title of a song by a Manchester band, right? And at the time that you were coming up, it was a fantastic time for it was a great time to be young in Manchester. Certainly, there was you know, there was the Mondays, there were the Stone Roses, obviously the Hacienda was going on. There were kids on the terraces at Main Row with the T-shirts that said "Forget Acid, I'm High on City," which was a magic time, wasn't it? A time of infinite possibilities, you know.
That's right. That's right. And certainly, I was the kind of person that would want to embrace that, because I'm so proud of Manchester, you know, and obviously. Everyone regarded the trends, the fashion, the music has been London-centric, and for a change, we were the sort of flagship, certainly musically at that time, and the Hacienda was the kind of, if you will, it was the sort of mecca for everyone that was into music, and into what was particularly cool at the time was to get to the Hass, and I certainly had a fair share of fantastic nights there. And yeah, just so proud of it, and so excited. And we talk about in the book how people like Janice Long had to deal with the Stone Roses and the Mondays being on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, yeah.
And seeing, you know, going from the Fine Young Cannibals, who were so neatly sort of presented, to the likes of Sean Ryder and Ian Brown, and it's just comical to sort of, and I always wondered what it was like to be a fly on the wall in the kind of in the dressing rooms there, you know, and you can think of the likes of those guys mixing with those kind of DJs and presenters, and seeing how they managed to go with it, because certainly Manchester was in your face at the time, and it was certainly out there, and it was a case of we're here to stay and deal with it. And it was just such a really fascinating time as well to see what became of certain bands and what they nurtured, and seeing the Stone Roses and obviously Oasis from that group, and so much fantastic talent has since come from those days. It really is such a proud time to be a Mancunian. But strangely enough, there wasn't really anybody else in my team of lads that actually embraced that. There's none of my teammates were into the music. It tended to be me, really, and I'd go with my pals, but I hardly ever saw any of the lads come to any of the gigs.
Yes, yeah, I can imagine. You had a bit of a Sean Ryder haircut at the time as well, didn't you?
I did, but I thought I carried it off slightly better than Sean did, to be really honest with you. But yeah, I did. It was just one of those things, wasn't it, that you do at the time, but certainly, as I say...
How would we describe that haircut now for our podcast listeners? It was kind of the curtains, wasn't it?
It was the curtains, the Aberdeen Angus, I don't know. But certainly, it doesn't look like it, or doesn't sound like it's particularly an attractive look. But when you've got a face like mine, you've got to hide it as best you can, really.
So, I mean, now you've done the physio stuff. You've got the book coming out. I know you're doing radio stuff. You do work with City again, and you're in a good place. Obviously, a much better place. When you're at home watching Match of the Day and you see sort of a kid of 22 picking up an injury, like Valencia last season or Ramsey the season before, Stuart Holden, what do you think? What would you like to say to those kids?
Well, obviously every player as well today has an agent.
Yes.
And that seems to be their sort of first port of call is that person as a confidant. But certainly what they have to be first and foremost is to appreciate that today medically there are so many sort of cross checks that the medical team will have to do. So they will assess initially, then they will go for a scan. Then they will have that scan read by a specialist. They will have a second and a third opinion. And that's just with injuries that are not necessarily particularly serious. Mm. So the more serious they are, the more in-depth the investigation. What the clubs then do is they will assess who is the leading consultant of the time. And there'll be two or three. They will decide then which person they're going to see. And so all the time, that communication is there for the players. So everything is open, everything's above board. But there is one thing, Steve, and that's what we all need to appreciate in life, is that nothing is a certainty. You know, it might be sort of 1% or 5% chance that in spite of all the best care and attention, that you're not the player that you were for whatever reason. Yeah. Depends on the severity of the injury. Now, certainly trauma injuries, where there's like a fracture and it's maybe a particular kind of fracture with ligament damage as well, then those traumas, you quite often don't come back to the player that you were. But for these young lads now, they have the supreme confidence that everyone medically, from the second division through to obviously the top flight, the Premiership, they have the best advice, the best attention, the best care. And the good thing is that, you know, lots of clubs now are open. So, for instance, the physios at Manchester City, Manchester United, might get a phone call from the physio at Dagenham and Redbridge.
Yes, yeah.
Or the physio at Macclesfield Town saying, look, I've got this player, he's had this, this and this, can you help me, please? And that's open now, and that's how the football world is. It really does look after its own. So they're quite fortunate they have got that backup. But even so, they still have to stick to the letter of the law. These guys are paid well, they understand that, but as long as they're taking the advice and they heed the advice and they don't take any risks by sort of off-the-pitch risks that they don't need to, you know, it's still a case that you do get one or two players that are loose cannons, that can do their own thing and think, well, I'm young, I'm strong, I can get away with it. But you can't. You know, you have to be very, very careful in what you do, because you can't be watched 24/7. And for a lot of the overseas players, they might not truly understand. And for the overseas players, if they're not sure, they should go back and they should make sure that they understand what's going on with their bodies, what's happening, and what do I need to do to make sure that I get back to the player that I was. And that communication, which was seriously lacking in the 80s, is ever present today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last thing, I mean, okay, so you're watching that Match of the Day again. I think you know what I'm going to ask you. You can't help but be jealous, right, of watching those guys running around and able to fulfil their potential. How have you managed to square that in your head over the years? And also, you know, was it worth that 10 years to play those 130 games and to play for Manchester City, or for anyone to play for the club that they grew up loving and supporting?
Well, I have to say, Steve, if I'm being honest, I do get envious. You know, just now and again, you just
who wouldn't?
A certain game, the pitch is looking a certain way, the crowd, the excitement. You know, I've been to games, you know, both at at City's newly named Etihad Stadium and to others, and just had a little taste of it up in pitch side, and just thought, you know, I would give anything to play today, and that still happens, and I've managed to cope with that is the realisation that there are still, you know, thousands, millions of young men that will never get the opportunity that I had to play for it and they supported as a child. And you know, that's something that I can take to my grave, knowing that I achieved fantastic things and my name's in and around the stadium, which I'm so, so proud of, as being one of the guys in the Hall of Fame. I do wish, though, that maybe I would have like not taken the last 30 games and then at least be able to go for a run. So, you know, yeah. From the sort of physical side, I am quite envious of that. But certainly, I cope with it because I always look forward. And that's the thing. You see, looking back has been cathartic, like I said before, with regard to writing the book. But I never look back now. I always look forward. What's happening next? And where are we going with this? So, as far as that's concerned, that's how I cope. But with regards to where I go now and what I do next, and how I come to terms with everything that's happened, then all I can say is that I'll look at the book and I will read the book and I'll pull out all of the great times that I had and those great pointers, and in the final part where Gary Cook says what he says, you know, it's such an uplifting end to the book, and there are so many highs in the book that kind of counterbalance those miserable times, that that achievement of writing that book with my wife, you know, is such a testament to my career, and to hopefully the fact that it can be put out to City fans to really enjoy and be proud of like we are, but also for the footballing world to be able to glean something from a life in football and a true depiction of how things were in those days.
Absolutely. Well, listen, it's a great book and you should be really proud of it, and you should be really proud of your career, you know. And it's called I'm Not Really Here. It's out on Century Hardback on August the 4th. And Paul, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Football is about nothing unless it's about something. And what it is about...
I am going to get 100% out of you.
Oh, well, of course, you've lived for days of different life.
Thank you for downloading this podcast, a Mirror Digital production. The Mirror Football podcast theme music is the cunningly titled Football by the band Peers. That's P-E-E-R-S. Check them out at myspace.com/wearepeers. myspace.com/wearepeers.